The committee will come to order. And the first bill up for consideration is Representative Murphy's bill. That's 328. Yes, thank you. And we have three bills up today, so we're gonna vote on this bill in half an hour. So please, the earlier testifiers, keep in mind that there's people coming after you, to be fair. Representative Murphy, and this is going to go to civil justice for your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to move House File 228 and we refer it to the Committee on Civil Justice.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. I have two amendments to begin.
Oh, can I just...
Would you like to gather in order, sir?
No, we'll do that afterwards. Go ahead.
Thank okay. You. The first is the A1 amendment.
Okay.
This amendment changes the effective date from July 2010 to August 2010.
Okay. Which amendment is that?
It is the A1.
A1, thank you. So, any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second amendment is the A2 amendment. It's on page 5. It essentially deletes lines 5.20 through 5.22. The language is, in my reading, redundant.
And what, can you just explain what that amendment does?
If you look at the current language, it is instructing when there's an entry of an order terminating the parental rights, it offers information about the right of a person to file at any time with the state register the vital statistics of consent for disclosure. That's part one. Part two, the right of a person to file at any time with the state register of vital statistics and affidavit stating that the information and the original birth record shall not be disclosed. And the third then would offer information about the effect of failure to file either consent to disclose or non-disclose.
And President Murphy, this removing this language does actually make it consistent with the rest of the bill you're doing, or does this change the? This is just kind of, in some sense, a technical amendment to make it consistent with everything else.
Correct, sir.
Okay. Is there any discussion? This is really to get the bill in the order the author wants, but any discussion on this? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Motion prevails.
House File 328 modifies and recodifies the law governing access to birth record information by adopted persons. Under current law, the right of the adopted person to have access to birth record information depends on when the adoption took place. For adoptions occurring before August 1st, 1977, the general rule is that the adopted person does not have access to birth record information without the consent of the birth parent. For adoptions occurring on or after August 1st, 1977, adopted persons age 19 or older have access to the information unless the birth parent has filed an affidavit stating that the information may not be disclosed. This bill would change the law to eliminate the distinction between pre- and post-1977 adoptions. In all cases, an adopted person would have access to a birth record information unless there's an affidavit of non-disclosure on file with the state register. Minnesota has a long history of adoption law, and over time, the law has balanced the desires of birth parents and the rights of adoptees. Providing adopted persons with the same rights as their counterparts who are raised in their biological families is a matter of legal equality, ethical practice, and basic fairness. I urge your support, and thank you for your time. And before I turn my time over to Ms. Needham, I'd like to just recognize the many advocates that are here, birth parents, adoptive parents, and adoptees who have been working on this legislation for very, very, very many years. I'm happy to carry the football with them for just a little while. Thank you.
Ms. Needham?
Yes.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Penelope Needham, last name spelled N-E-E-D-H-A-M. I'm a member of the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, which includes birth parents, adoptive professionals, and people who are interested in changing Minnesota's laws to be simpler. And I think you have a handout in your packet. I hope you received this legal side sheet. It shows the current process for an adopted person requesting a birth certificate, which is complicated. It can take a long time. It can cost a lot of money. And to be replaced by House File 328, it would look like this. And this is half of it. So a much simpler process based upon the affidavit of non-disclosure and the affidavit of disclosure. So respecting the wishes of the birth parent. I'm here to talk about how HF 328 is about the best interest of the child who is now an adult. The adopted child in Minnesota who requests a birth certificate by this process will continue to honor the affidavits of disclosure and non-disclosure signed by birth parents. And that would allow the birth parents to file or again refile and rescind, change their mind on the affidavits in the future also. The bill would simplify the process for adult adoptees who want a non-certified copy of their original birth certificate. The current process, as I said, was complicated. The current charges are about $625 to the placing agency to search for birth parents to ask them for the affidavit of non-disclosure if they don't have one on file. And then if they get an affidavit of non-disclosure, they still, after paying the money, do not receive the original birth certificate copy, non-certified. This process would simplify it, and the Department of Health would simply issue the non-certified copy to the adoptee if there were no non-disclosure affidavits on file. Adoptions were created in the best interest of the child to provide permanent parents for children whose birth parents were unable to parent. The birth parents' rights were terminated. The original birth certificate was altered. A new name was given to the child, and the adoptive parents' names were listed in place on the birth in place of the birth parent's name. The original reason for closing the adoption records was to protect the adopted person, or in the best interest of the child, to protect them from scrutiny, discrimination, or public ridicule. Why is it now in the best interest of this child, now adult, to release the data with a new process? I'll give you five simple reasons. One, it's respectful. This is information vital to the person named on the certificate. It is about that person. It's information that they need to know who they are and where they came from. Second, it will save time and money and effort to simplify this process. Three, the health risks will be reduced with access to current medical history by virtue of having access to where you came from. Health costs would be less. Unnecessary diagnostic testing and treatment experiments are performed when medical histories are known. And finally, family ties are strengthened. The ability to reconnect with lost relatives and to know the truth of who you are is an important part of our social and emotional health. The opposition says that they know personally birth parents who fear the telling of their secrets will destroy their marriages and family relationships. To say that someone knows that the birth parent is to say that this birth parent's secret is no longer a secret. A legislator or agency should ethically help this birth parent follow the existing state law to file an affidavit of non-disclosure as soon as possible to protect their privacy. This will remain in effect. The form is readily available here. I brought some with me. And on the website from the Department of Health. And finally, this is compromise legislation. There will still be adopted adults who cannot get their birth certificates because some birth parents will have filed a form of non-disclosure. Birth parents will still need to take responsibility to file an affidavit if they do not want the original birth certificate released. We will all have to wait until August 1st, 2010 for a simplified process to take effect. It also involves a little more work. We have committed, as the Minnesota Coalition of Adoption Reform, with other adoption advocates and agencies and institutions to help publicize and educate and facilitate post-adoption support during the transition period and beyond. And with your help, most of the Minnesota adopted adults and 90% who have filed affidavits are positive in the state Department of Health will have access to this vital information. We will also be joining other states who currently have open access. The movement is growing. At last count, there were about 10 who had open access and another 4 with some works in progress, and legislative efforts are going on in other states also. So we're hoping that Minnesota will join and that you can help with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So Representative Murphy, it seems to, or to the witness testifier, it seems to me that the two big changes in this bill are anyone now that files an affidavit of non-disclosure has the option of going to court, where in the past that wasn't the case. If you filed a non-disclosure, that was the end of the ballgame for most situations. And the second change is that for people that filed before 1997, for people that the adoption took place after 1977, after 1977, nothing filed, there's a presumption you can release the record. Before 1977, there's a presumption you can't release the record, and this would change that. So if there's nothing on file for everybody now, you can release the record. Are those the two big kind of differences here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to get this. Prior to 1977, if an adopted adult wanted to see their original birth certificate, they needed to go to court. So for those, and we changed the law in 1977, so for adoptees prior to 1977, if there is an affidavit of disclosure, there's an affidavit of non-disclosure, the adoptee doesn't get access to their record unless they go to court. After 1977, the birth parent can file. The birth parent is the person who files the affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure. If the birth parent files an affidavit of non-disclosure, then the adoptee, the adult adoptee, has no access to their birth certificate unless they go to court.
And I'm just looking at this chart, and it looks like, okay, that if there's an affidavit of non-disclosure and the birth parent can't be located, there's no way, you can't even go to court under current law. And so I'm just, it seems, this chart is really helpful. I think everybody that presents here should, this is for everybody in the audience, this is actually a really good document. So, okay, there we go. Okay, well, are there other questions, members? I think I got the gist of that. Representative Glosser, I know you have an amendment. I don't know if you want to go to that right now.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair, and I think we have to look at it from both sides, and this is, the chart is looking at it from the adoptee standpoint, but there's also, I think, a key issue, which is that the birth parent prior to 1977 was not given the option of filing a certificate of non-disclosure. Instead, they were promised that was confidential information that would never, under any circumstances, be disclosed. And my understanding is, though, that they can go to court and get a disclosure if the court finds a compelling reason to have someone contact the pre-1977 birth parent and try and obtain whatever medical or other critical information is available. So I'm not quite sure. I'd like to know maybe from Ms. Ayes if I'm understanding it correctly, that you could go to court for pre-77, but the court would have to weigh a very serious standard to make it available.
Ms. Ayes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blossler.
I know.
It's my understanding that any birth parent at any time, no matter when the adoption was finalized, has the right to go to the Department of Health and file an affidavit of non-disclosure, even pre-1977.
But they weren't offered it.
But they have the right to do that now. So, and it's my understanding also that if there is no affidavit on file, then you can go to court and ask for the court to release the record. But there is a fairly high, I mean, the court has to weigh, you know, who's, in whose best interest is release of, or non-release of the record, court decision. According to the statute, if a person was adopted on or after August 1st, 77, it appears that the Commissioner of Health shall release the information unless there's an affidavit of non-disclosure on file.
Representative Emmer.
I want to follow up the question, or the answer anyway. You said that everyone prior to 1977 would have an option to file this affidavit of non-disclosure. And Representative Loeffler, the way you set that out is there was a promise made by the state that under no circumstance would it be disclosed. So how do you get around people that have passed on, birth parents that have passed on? Because in fact, that's not true. Not everyone will be able to file an affidavit of non-disclosure if they're no longer with us. So how do you honor the promise? How do you address it?
Well, according to this chart, if the birth parent died under current law, you can go to court.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So that the issue comes up when either you don't, or you can't find the birth parent. So you don't know if they're alive or not, and you don't know where they are, and you can't. That seems to me to be kind of the core issue here. But please go ahead, the testifier.
Yes, Karen Gibson. We do have birth parents in the audience who did place children before 1977 who were not guaranteed privacy and could speak to that if you so desire. So that the statement that they were assured is not universally held by birth parents.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. I have a document from the House Research Department from June 17, 2004 that states the procedure required. This is a document called Adopted Persons Access to Adoption Records, Legislative History. And I'm looking at 1977. And it states the procedure required the Commissioner of Public Welfare to notify each parent identified on the original birth record within 6 months of the request and gave the birth parent an opportunity to file an affidavit consenting or objecting to the release of the information. So when they changed the law in 1977, according to this history, there was an effort to reach out to the birth parent and give them an opportunity to file an affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure. And then I'd like to add one more thing. And Representative Emmer, you know I'm not a lawyer. I'm reading from a document.
That's no excuse, Mr. Chairman.
And it states that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a birth parent's right to privacy does not supersede the rights of adopted adults to access their own private information, and that the adoptee access to birth records does not violate either living or deceased parents, a deceased birth parent's rights to privacy. So the court has suggested, from my perspective, that the rights of the adoptees are as important or more important than the rights of the adopted parent, or the birth parent.
What's that case?
That's what I don't have.
Okay. I wonder if that's constitutional. Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So taking this to the next step, I just want to understand this. I believe you have a year kind of time frame where you're going to give persons before 1977 the option of filing an affidavit if they did not, if I'm understanding this correct, it'll give the original birth parent the right to make a statement, and yet, and so I'm looking for clarification on what I just heard here. So even if they do fill out that affidavit, the courts have still said that the child has the right to that information, so they could still go to court. If I'm understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that's correct, but as Ms. Needham said, this is a compromise. The language you see before you is a compromise, and there's been many years of work among agencies, adopted agencies, Department of Human Services, Department of Health, adoptees, birth parents, and adopted parents. They've they've agreed through this work that we should have a year between when we pass this law and when the law goes into effect to allow the agencies, and they've developed a plan, and I believe that's in your handout, to do outreach to make sure we do our level best to reach out to those birth parents and give them the opportunity to fill out their single-page form so that we are honoring the promise that was made, though some would argue it was a promise the state could not offer, and protect the feelings and feelings of privacy and the need for privacy by those birth parents. But we've also agreed that from the adoptee's perspective, it is important to have access to that information. It's important for them to be treated as the same as a child in their original birth family.
Representative.
Thanks. Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, sorry, but you're confusing me again. Was the promise made or wasn't it made? Now I've heard it. Representative Loeffler made the statement that a promise was made. You just made it again and said that, or offered, suggested that maybe it was a promise that couldn't be made. Will you tell me what's the promise we're talking about, we're referring to?
Representative Murphy.
Chair and Representative Emmer, I wasn't here in 77. I think that there were probably adoption agencies that did suggest that birth certificates and this information would remain private. The courts have said they didn't have the right to do that. The courts have said that because a birth parent doesn't have the right to adoption, to say, the state then does not have the right, the birth parent doesn't have the right to privacy granted by the state when there was no right in the beginning. And that's as far as my legal argument is going to go. So I think agencies back in 1977, because of cultural and historical perspectives, offered birth mothers a promise of privacy that some courts have argued is not actually there to meet. And so, it is confusing.
So what that would mean, basically, is even if we don't change the law, people could still go to court under that constitutional right to have their own information, basically. I think.
That's why I'm asking.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, if the courts have made that decision, then we don't have anything to decide.
Except to ease the process. Right. Representative Abler.
Well, I just was thought I'd phone a friend. I'm not a lawyer, and I never wanted to be one. And I was just curious, Ms. Abe remembers the law. She's pretty good at this. Can you offer me, I think it was an assurance that was intended, and I think there was a duty to protect the kids, wasn't there, in some of this? And could Ms. Abe's comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it's my understanding that what you're saying is correct. It was to protect the child. I do not know the court case that Representative Murphy is referring to. I can find that and give it to anybody that's interested that's out there. But it was to protect the child.
Representative Loeffler, do you have an amendment?
Yes.
Or do we want to have the opponents? Is there people here to testify in opposition to the bill? Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the H.O. 328A3 amendment. And members, what this will do is make the provisions in this bill only effective for adoptions completed on or after August 1st, 1977. That does not prevent any birth parent before that, from based on the publicity that this authorizes, stepping forward and signing an affidavit of non-disclosure or disclosure, and indicating a willingness to connect to someone. But I think there's a basic issue of, Aaron said this is a bill about basic fairness, and I tend to think it is as well, and that this is about those women who gave up their child maybe in the 20s, maybe in the 30s. I've been contacted by two very elderly seniors, okay? So it's not just about people who had a child out of wedlock in the 50s or 60s. I mean, this goes back all the way. And yesterday we had a hearing on which sexual violence, not all of these pregnancies were the result of youthful passion and indiscretion. Some of these were the result of rape or incest or other situations that were very, very terrible experiences in the lives of these women. And the typical experience for women for many decades was that you were sent away, and the story was that you were going off to help an aunt who needed help in some other town, or you went off to find a job somewhere. But you went off to a maternity home, and there's one a few blocks from me that doesn't exist right now in that function, but it was built as a maternity home for unwed mothers to hide out until they could deliver their babies and then return to a more integrated life in the community. And I think that when women gave birth in the 30s and 40s and 50s and were told, and I'm sure the practice varied from hospital to hospital and social worker and agency to agency, because I don't think back then we'd put as high a value on consistency, were told that this was confidential information that would never be made available. They really believed that. And unlike the birth mothers after 1977, they weren't given a piece of paper in which they could indicate their preferences. And so it seems to me that the use of the intermediary, which is available now through the court, is a responsible way to go for those pre-1977 adoptions. And so once again, this would simply provide that the outreach would go forward that's in this bill. That may bring some mothers forward who want to connect with their children. They may want to anonymously provide medical information. But for those who choose not to, the court process would be the way that remains. And for outreach to this group of people, most of the seniors, many of the people who are younger in my district, do not have access to the web or use it regularly. I see a long list of ways to reach out to people, but once you get into your senior years, people tend to have much more isolated information sources. And so I'm not sure that the outreach for this particular group, many of whom may have married, changed their names, that it's going to be as effective as one would hope. But I'm hoping that the publicity does encourage many birth parents to step forward and share their information. But I think when we're going to make laws that are retroactive to things that happened decades before, we should be very, very thoughtful about that. And I think we should honor the commitments that were made to many of these women, maybe not all of them, because we don't know what the circumstances of each of these were, and say that for adoptions completed before they were offered that affidavit and non-disclosure, that we honor that commitment and go through the current process, which is you go to the court. And if you have a compelling reason because of medical issues or other things, that you can approach the court with those issues, and they will determine the situation. The health consequences and family ties that might be strengthened for some may also be ripped asunder for someone else on both sides. For someone who has been adopted to find out that their parent was a rapist, it can be just as disruptive as for someone who gave up a child in a very difficult situation to suddenly have to be put back into that situation and living through those decisions again. So that's the reason I'm offering this amendment, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I've had a chance to talk with Representative Lasso about this. And the advocates and myself are opposed to the amendment because it essentially takes effect of current law. It what it does is undo what we're trying to do, which is to create equality among those born before 1977 and after 1977 and getting access to their original birth certificate.
Okay. Reverend Bryce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to combine your amendment with the court case that we just heard that I haven't seen, so I'm anxious to see it. But if the court case says that the rights of the individual to have their records supersedes the privacy concern on the other side, then I don't know how we could put an arbitrary date in place. And so it just seems to me there's a conflict between those two things, between the case that's out there and between this amendment. So I'm anxious to see that language so I can see how it actually might work its way through. But the way I'm hearing it, I'm not sure it could.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's all hard for all of us to deal with a court case that we don't even know which court it was and what the circumstances was. And this bill will be going to public safety or civil law so that they can review that. I just, you know, it may have been a case, for example, where someone needed a transplant and it was a medically compelling reason that would not, the court may not have had limitations on when they would apply that interpretation. I'm not sure. I'm speculating as much as anyone as to what it might be. And so I would respectfully ask that if you believe we should give much more serious weight to the issue of those pre-1977 adoptions by honoring what we understand were the commitments made to them and the fact that they weren't offered an opportunity to sign a piece of paper that will still be honored, that would have been signed by a parent in 1980 or 1995 or last year, that did not have that chance to sign an affidavit of non-disclosure, that we exempt them from this process, we continue the court process, where if there are compelling reasons, you can go to the court and have those records opened. And so I respectfully ask that we let the Civil Law Committee debate the court rulings, and they will actually have it in front of them, and they'll have much more attorneys around the table to understand the implications than we do.
Representative Murphy, thank you, Representative Murphy, my understanding is that this amendment goes on. If you've located the birth parent and they sign an affidavit of non-disclosure, then there's no court access. And if the birth parent is deceased, you would have court, then there's no something on file, you would have court access. But you wouldn't have it if you find the birth parent and they file an affidavit of disclosure. There's no court access whatsoever. Is that right? Please identify yourself.
My name is Terry Glazner, B-L-E-S-C-N-E-R. Hopefully I can clarify a little bit. I'm a social worker. I have a master's degree. I did my thesis paper on Minnesota adoption. So I've done some research on the laws here, and I hopefully can clarify for you. 1917, the law that was passed in Minnesota, actually was to protect the adoptive family, the adoptee primarily. So the records were closed to the public, but not to the parties of interest, which would be the adoptee, the adopted parents, and the birth parents. Somewhere in the late 40s, Minnesota, and I couldn't find it, it was never really hotly debated, but we closed the records. Then we've got these affidavit of disclosures and non-disclosures in 77 and 82. The gist of it is, if there is an affidavit of non-disclosure on file, an adoptee theoretically could pay the money to go to court to ask a judge to, order the birth parent to do something. I can tell you anecdotally, most folks do not have success with that, even if they've got medical issues that they've had to go to court for to try and get an order. They haven't been very successful. It costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of time. Affidavit. So currently as it stands, it doesn't preclude you from going to court. I think you always have the option to go to court on an issue if you choose to. But affidavits, we would honor the affidavits of non-disclosure. Those would remain. There are affidavits. Any birth parent has the option of filing an affidavit of disclosure at any time. Birth parents prior to 77 may not have been offered them. However, they can file them at any time should they choose to. There's many birth parents that are in the audience that will tell you that they filed an affidavit of disclosure and their adoptions occurred prior to 77. There's birth parents in the audience who will tell you that they were promised that their children would be given their information when they turned 19. I believe that agencies, I don't believe they did it, recklessly, but I think that they, in those times, told birth parents what they wanted to hear. If birth parents wanted to be held to secrecy, then that's what the agency or the social worker would tell them would happen. If these birth parents came to them and said, I can't parent, but I want to in 20 years be able to find them, I think that those might have been, that may have been leaned that way. There are no contracts that you'll find signing that would ever have given them the promise of anonymity. There is no contract signed by anyone that says you will never be found. And quite honestly, if we are never adopted, I have to have a birth certificate, so you can't promise her that I will never know who I am, because up until 1977, adoptees could be returned in 5 years if there was epilepsy or something else. So there's no absolute guarantee that I would never know who I was. I was found, the likelihood that I would be adopted in those times is good, and most of us were. But you can't tell me there's an absolute guarantee that I would never find out who I was, because that birth certificate is mine, as is my other birth certificate. So, I don't know if that clarifies it at all.
That's helpful. Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Representative Loeffler if you've given any thought to, if your amendment was to go on and the bill would pass, whether there would be any additional burden on the court. You know, because you'd be having the publicity about the bill, and, you know, you'd have some people who then would recognize that they, you know, it might give them the idea that now we can go to court. So have you given that any thought?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, it seems to me that it could actually work both ways. You would have, because of the publicity, birth parents who may have had a change of heart and now want to contact and will actually share information with, you know, Lutheran Social Services or whatever agency they went through and said, if someone tries to reach me, here's my contact information. I think you'll have people who will step forward and sign that affidavit of non-disclosure, because they'll now be aware that there is a form that they can use. And I think, you know, it'll be a mixed mechanism. I don't know that we can say for sure which way it would tilt. I don't know.
Representative Mack. Or did you have, did that? Okay, Representative Mack. Did you have a question? No. Okay. Any other discussion on the amendment, members? All right, seeing none. All in favor, this is the A3 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no?
No.
The amendment does not prevail. To the any other questions on the bill, members? Representative Emmer.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's not making a whole lot of sense when what you read from a court case, by the way, for my colleague's benefit, I'm not a chiropractor and I never had any inkling to be one. Representative Murphy, what's not making any sense to me is there's apparently a court case that in effect says that the adoptee's rights are equal to or greater than the birth parent's rights, and yet now we can do an affidavit of non-disclosure, and the testimony is that even if there's some compelling reason, typically they're not overturned by the court. I have a few questions that goes to the birth certificate, because, I mean, this is an important issue, and I felt one way a year ago. I feel a little differently now. But I'd like you to clarify some things for me so I can make up my mind. First, what is the information that you actually get off the birth certificate?
Mr. Chair, it's essentially the name, address. Actually, I've only seen my amended birth certificate. My understanding is that an original birth certificate contains more information. However, it would have the name of the birth mother, perhaps the name of the birth father, if she named him, but it wasn't a legal requirement. It would have the place of birth, date of birth, and that would be, I mean, it's not a lot of information. It simply is what's on your birth certificate, I imagine, which is the names of your birth parents. And your father, if they were married, would have probably been named, but if not married, most likely is not on there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that was my understanding, because the argument that I've heard many times, and I've had someone who's a friend, I've become a friend only because she married into a family that I know pretty well. And by the way, Aaron, I see that you're in the room. My condolences to you and the rest of the Americans for the loss of LT. Great man. You talk about access to health records. Well, there's no guarantee, Mr. Chair, and the witness or Representative Murphy, that the birth parents would ever want to provide that information. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chair, you're correct.
And Matt, could you re-identify yourself for the record?
My name is Carrie Blesner.
Okay. B-L-E-S-N-E-R?
B-L-E-S-E-N-E-R.
All right, thanks. Okay.
In terms of medical records, You are correct. However, if I have the name of the person and I don't have to go through my agency, spend $700 a year. For instance, I'll use myself as an example. My mother filed an affidavit of non-disclosure. They asked her for medical information. She refused. There's nothing else I can do. I suppose I could go to the court, could have gone to the court and asked them to order her. I don't have thousands of dollars to do that, to make her file or provide me the information. However, had I had her birth name, I could have used other means or contacted other people to obtain that information about my health that I think I could have done in a respectful and confidential way. I had a third party, had my doctor contact someone to get that information if I had that. If I have nothing to go on, I had no information. So when I go to my doctor, I have to do the big X through all of your health history and have to go through tests now because I have no background.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Lasner, this is very uncomfortable because, it's a very emotional issue, and maybe I'll be the bad guy in the room, but the problem that I'm having is, while I understand that, there's also the birth parent who has said, I don't want to, it's very awkward, but I don't want to disclose who I am. I don't want to do that. We do have, thankfully nowadays, testing, genetic testing, all kinds of things that you can do. And I'm not saying that's perfect, and I hope nobody in the room thinks that I know better than you do. I don't. I'm just, it's a difficult situation when you try to balance the feelings and the... Representative Loeffler, you hit part of it. The other part is, what happens when somebody who does not want to be disclosed, all of a sudden you throw that pebble into the pond and the ripples can be very dramatic through families. It's going to go to civil justice or whatever the name of the committee is now. There are going to be issues, legal issues, that arise. There's all kinds of things that the vote that we're taking today, even though I really have struggled with this one for quite a while, I just think that you're treading in areas where the birth parent made a decision, and we're essentially saying that we don't have to honor that, I believe.
Mr. Chair, I believe... We are honoring that. We have compromised. We have worked with the agencies. They are no longer opposed to our bill. We are honoring that. You file that affidavit of non-disclosure, which is perhaps 10% when we've done it here. It's 10% non-disclosure, 90% for disclosure. 90% birth mothers want this.
Right.
We are honoring the 10%, which we have not previously, in previous years, we have asked for full access. You will find many organizations across the country who would not. Who would say that adoptees have the right to their full self. We are making a concession and a compromise. We will honor those 10%, which means myself, I won't get this information. I'm standing before you, but I don't get this information, but I believe that strongly, that 90% of people should not be held back by 10% who can make their wishes known with a simple affidavit. No one will know. You can file that. Keep it on file. You can take it back in 10 years if she so chooses. But I believe that this bill is a good bill. We've worked long and hard to come to this compromise, and I believe that we are honoring in a respectful manner both sides of this debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any closing comments from Mr. Murphy?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think, you are weighing in on what is a difficult policy question, and I'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Murphy is going to renew her motion that House File 328 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Members, what we're going to do now, we have two bills that we're going to take up. In light of the time, we're not going to get to House File 42 today, so we'll hold off on that. We are going to hear two bills. Bill that Representative Broad and I are going to present, and then a bill that Representative Fritz is going to present. We're not going to be voting on them. We're going to be looking at we're going to have a couple more days on long-term care, and then I think trying to assemble a committee bill of ideas about how to move forward on long-term care as we move going forward. So we're just going to have questions answered as the bill presented, and Representative Liebling.
We didn't even have to move it. Okay. Yeah. I came over here to
Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Thiessen, welcome to your committee, and do you want to move your bill?
Yeah, so Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to move, I'll move House File 247 put before the committee and set up for consideration in omnibus, laid over consideration in omnibus. I'm not sure that's the right word, but a committee bill at some point.
All right. Representative Thiessen moves House File 247. To be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy long-term care bill.
Thank you.
And I understand that you have a motion to get the bill. I'm sorry, you don't. Okay, so the bill is in the order in which you would like to discuss it. Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, we're just tag teaming here. Representative Thiessen and I have been working on this issue, which essentially sets up something like is already currently available for college savings plans. This sets up a proposal that provides for people to have a tax subtraction or a tax deferred benefit for setting up a long-term savings plan. As we look at our budgets, it's very clear that we need to start doing things differently. All you have to do is look at demographics to know that we can't do what we're doing today out into the future. And so we need to start looking at things, changing things, altering things, and changing mindsets along the way. What this plan will do is encourage people and incent people to do what they probably should be doing already, but to save for their own long-term care needs. And as we look at the cost of providing long-term care, right now it falls heavily on the state and other public agencies. And you know what? The folks who are able to plan and are able to save for their long-term care ought to be doing that. And this gives one mechanism to do so. Madam Chair and members, this is a flexible mechanism that allows people to save for long-term care needs. It allows them to save for nursing home needs, but also for care within their own homes as well, which I think is a key component of the bill. The bill also allows people to use the dollars that they set aside for the purposes of purchasing long-term care insurance. So this is one of those things that brings all sorts of good ideas together in a way that will both help the budget, but also will set us up to succeed much better into the future. And so, Madam Chair and members, I think do you want to say anything more? Should we bring up we have Catherine Roberts from Eckenden who wants to make a few comments related to the bill. But it really is a new way of thinking about long-term care in our state. Nebraska was the first in the nation to put together a proposal like this. And the more states we can get moving forward in this manner, the more likely we are to get the federal government to act as well. And so I'm real excited about working with this, working with Representative Thiessen on this effort.
And Madam Chair, while she's coming up, the only thing I would say is kind of what one of the things that drives me on this is we basically have a public policy in this state for long-term care that forces people to go into poverty to take care of themselves for long-term care needs. And what this bill is kind of a small step in the direction of saying we should have a different kind of public policy that looks at trying to get people to prepare in advance so we're not forcing them into poverty before they can kind of access their long-term care benefits.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Roberts. I'm the CEO of Ecumen,
which is the state's largest nonprofit provider of services to people who are aging. And every day I work with about 4,000 people, all of us intent on changing the way services are delivered to seniors, and a significant portion of that is thinking about how funding can change in order to serve, in order to provide services that are different than we think of today. And I'd like to make that perhaps more real, I'd like to give an example of two or three services that Ecumen provides that is different, and I think this bill would provide a mechanism to allow more people to take advantage of. We know that technology is vital to aging well in Minnesota. And one approach that we have taken is using technologies such as unobtrusive home sensors that help identify emerging health issues before they grow larger. This kind of technology allows adult kids to follow the progress of their parents, for example, thousands of miles away, and keep track of their conditions, and it also allows the parents to stay in their homes. Another approach that we're offering that we think is different and really would benefit with this funding that's been proposed is we provide a new very specialized rehab center in Duluth. People can come in who've had a hip replaced or a knee replaced, and they come into this center rather than into a nursing home, which we know provides services to people with very different needs. It's a program that provides a very vital respite link between a hospital stay and someone going back home again. In Chisago City, another very different kind of example, we're drawing hundreds of people from the surrounding community into our campus to our wellness center. The wellness center provides everything from cooking classes to therapeutic swimming, and it is people of all ages coming into a hub where they see aging done in a very successful way and paying again to remain healthier and to remain independently, keep an independent lifestyle for a much longer period of time. Another example might be, some of you may have seen an article in the St. Paul paper last week about a model that's emerging down by the Guthrie Theater. We have pulled together a group out of 13 condominiums down around the Guthrie Theater and created a virtual retirement community that's called Mill City Commons. They probably would not like the word retirement. They'd like to be identified as a group that's really aging in a vital way, and they are determined to age in their own homes and want someone to support them in that process. And Ecumen is doing that and providing a real common bond for them in their desire to stay connected and to stay engaged and, again, living in their own home and neighborhood. And for us, the connection to all of these new kinds of services that we are generating and putting in place is about really living independently and having many choices in the way you choose to age. Those new innovative ideas for service are really going to require a new way to pay for aging services, and we think the bill that's proposed today really will support that. The bill underscores increased personal participation. It's not simply government participation, and we think that's really important. It begins to show us a way to slow down government spending by having more people help pay for their own services while preserving a safety net for those who need it. It also points to family and multi-generational planning. If I have the account and don't spend it, it goes to my heirs. And it also allows people to self-direct their dollars to the services that they most desire to keep them independent. We believe transformation is absolutely critical as we enter this unprecedented age wave, and again, this legislation begins to take us in a new essential direction for transforming how we pay for those services. I'd be happy answering questions.
Hey, Representative Gottwald has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question, I just want to throw my support very strongly behind this bill. Some of you may recall that last year, I carried a tax credit, just a straight tax credit for long-term care coverage. But the whole idea of giving people the opportunity to put aside money for their own long-term care coverage and to give them those options that that creates. And, you know, right now so many people when they get into their later years are advised by their financial advisors to spend off their assets and go on medical assistance. And as we've seen, that is not only a bad choice for them as patients and consumers of health care, but it's, we simply can't afford it anymore. Bottom line. So, I mean, this is a wonderful proposal, and I strongly support it. Hope members will get behind it too.
Okay, other questions for members? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick questions. If this was patterned after the 529 plans, like the education accounts, a couple of quick things, like the 529 plans account for they can change beneficiaries really at any time to family members. You said it would transfer down to heirs. Is that only upon a death, or can that transfer happen at any time, first of all?
Madam Chair and Representative Kelly, it's transferable, certainly. And what another component of this plan is that you actually can set up a plan and use the dollars for some and not necessarily just for yourself. And so the goal is to make it flexible and to make it useful for not just my putting a plan together for me, but for all my family members as well. So it certainly is transferable.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one other item to the 5.9 is it allowed individuals to prepay up to 5-year level. So instead of the $2,000, it'd be a $10,000 prepayment in the account. Would that be possible with this account?
I certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Kelly, I think it's an interesting idea, but it's not part of this proposal.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. This is based on a Nebraska model, and I'm on the House Tax Committee, so we'll talk about the fiscal stuff there. But do you know what percent of eligible seniors have taken advantage of that? I'm just trying to do back of envelope math times $2,400 each year.
Thank you. That's a good question. And the take up on the Nebraska plan has been okay. To be quite honest, it hasn't been overwhelming, but there's some distinctions between Nebraska and, as I understand it, but there's some distinctions between Nebraska and Minnesota in terms of kind of our population versus their population that suggests that the take-up actually may be bigger in Minnesota, but we don't have those figures exactly yet. And since it's going to the Tax Committee and, you know, there's... quite honestly, other issues with the tax chair and others about tax credit. We have, you know, that obstacle to overcome, but we don't have the exact numbers right now.
And Madam Chair, we also the numbers are different than in Nebraska. Nebraska is considering right now actually increasing the tax credit in a manner that is much closer to where we started. So I think in order to do something like this, you have to make it lucrative enough to get people to buy into the idea. And I think the 2,000, 4,000 number does that. It's a significant subtraction. If you look at the subtractions or credits that are out there, this certainly is a very significant number, and I think is an incentive in a way that Nebraska is probably going to reach towards.
Okay, members, unless you're pressing questions right now, we do have another testifier on this bill, and maybe we could get that person testifying, and then if there are questions, we'll have the full array of people to direct those toward. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Hi. Excuse me. My name is Larae Kanatarud, and I am Director of Aging Transformation at the Department of Human Services. And I was asked, Madam Chair and members of the committee, not to speak directly to this bill, but to give you a quick update on a report that I worked on about 4 years ago, which was called Financing Long-Term Care for Minnesota's Baby Boomers. And we are working on an update of that will be done later this year, but being asked to say just a few words about what has happened since we wrote the report, I'll just do that very quickly. That legislatively mandated report asked for us to look at private long-term care options that we could see that baby boomers might take up as they moved into their retirement years. And basically our bottom line was that we needed a variety of options because people are in different situations and you know, what might work for one would not work for another. One of the things we looked at was the issue of savings, and at that point we had a negative number in savings, in the last couple of weeks, the good news is that our savings rate has gone up. This is a national figure, to about 3.5% because of the financial crisis that we went through. On the other hand, only about 49% of workers in America have less than $25,000 in their savings and investment. And so because of the 401k issues and the decline in that, there continues to be some issues related to savings. We also, in the report, looked at long-term care insurance and the partnership option, and the legislature subsequently passed a bill to set up the partnership program. It started being sold in December of 07, and we will know later this year more about the numbers of people who have taken up those policies. We have lots of insurance companies that are selling those policies, and we interpreted that flexibly so that we hope that that will increase the take-up of that. In terms of general long-term care insurance that we also looked at, the anecdotal information is that there's been a steady but perhaps a small increase in the take-up of long-term care insurance recently. The sense is that people are realizing after the financial situation of the last few months that they can't necessarily insure themselves against the risk, and they need to look at other tools and other ways of managing the risk of long-term care. Another thing that we looked at was reverse mortgages, and that has actually been in the news quite a bit because that's one of the kinds of mortgages that continues to increase. We've been pretty steady in Minnesota. We have about 1,100 of those. Excuse me, 1,100 of those per year in the last two or three years. But what's interesting is that more people are going into retirement with a mortgage rather than mortgage-free, and that can make about an $800 a month difference in people's ability to provide for their expenses. So with this new wrinkle, it looks like reverse mortgage might be used to manage debt as opposed to be used for long-term care quite as much. The stimulus bill has some additional provisions about reverse mortgage that may affect some of this. Finally, I wanted to just pass on some anecdotal information about people planning for retirement. In the report, we said that this is really important for people to start looking at their responsibility to plan for retirement. And anecdotally, we've seen from financial planners and community colleges and community ed that after a decline in interest in classes related to financial planning, now they're packed, and people are starting to realize that this is something, after they got over the being stunned by what happened to their 401k and so forth, they're starting to realize that they have to take some action. So we're going to be working on the update, and we'll certainly bring that to you when we're finished with it later this year.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Knatterud. I remember going to their original presentation on this and went, oh my gosh, we're not ready. But the one thing I didn't see here and that I was the question I was going to ask the authors about is I don't see a breakdown of single versus married couple households, and I think that's a really relevant issue here because people who are single their entire life are disproportionately may not have children, may not be able to merge an account like this would allow between married spouses, and I'm wondering if you would have any advice on whether we should consider allowing single people to actually save more because they are less likely to have potentially other people to support them. I know I think I've heard that 20% of all people do not have children at any point during their life, and so for them planning is probably even more important, but it's probably more expensive because they won't have a child to do part of it. They'll probably have to hire home care for almost all of it.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, Ms. Knatterud, we do have some brand new information that would be available and helpful for the actual costs for individuals and for couples related to living expenses in retirement. The Elder Economic Security Index was just launched on Tuesday of this week, and that has county by county specific information on the cost of housing, food, health care, transportation, and others, and it includes long-term care costs as well.
So that would be a great resource to take a look at what it's actually costing. And I think it does bear out that, you know, there's not twice the expense if you have a couple as opposed to an individual.
And Resident Loeffler, just to, I think that's something worth looking into, and I don't know from a revenue department kind of standpoint what the impact of that would be, but I think that's a fair point that we'll take into consideration, absolutely.
Yeah, Representative Mack had a question.
Thank you, Chair. I am just wondering, in the bill, it talks about, it's in subdivision 2 under section 1, and it talks about a lifetime maximum of $175,000 may be contributed by a participant. I'm just wondering on that dollar amount and if that's kind of following the Nebraska model or how that was arrived at and why there's a maximum amount of input.
Right. Madam Chair and Representative Mack, it certainly does follow along with the Nebraska model. It's a matter of investment, and it's also just a matter of when you have how much money can you sock away and how much subtraction and income, dollars off your income can you get? It's just, it's really a number out of the air, if you will. I wish I could say something different. Maybe Representative Keaton has a different opinion than I do.
Okay.
And then I have one other question. Are employers able to contribute to these accounts and get tax exemptions? Is it strictly the individual can contribute? Are employers able to as well?
Representative Broad.
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, this specific proposal is for individuals.
Okay, other questions from members? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any provisions for people to move money around, say, from IRAs or 401(b)s or any other retirement accounts into this fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, because this is those are federal things and this is a state thing, we don't have the authority to allow the withdrawal from those other kind of accounts without penalty to put into this account. If this were to be adopted on a national level, I don't know what the answer would be, but as a state legislature, we can't do that.
Okay, are there other questions, members? Okay, I have a question. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back to my one question about front-end loading the policy, working in this area for a long time, we do know that the long-term care risk is the biggest liability that any of our retirees face. So, unfortunately, though, they don't start thinking about this until they get closer to the 55 to 60 range. So, just that ability to maybe front-end load to possibly put in that $10,000 instead of $2,000 would be, I think, some enticement in. But my second thought would be, I understand this is probably a federal issue. Would there be any way for us to exempt the other individual who's not needing the care from the Medicaid spend down? Because if we're enticing people to create two different accounts and a spouse goes into a nursing home prior, is there going to be any protection here for that second account? And like I say, that might be a federal issue.
Representative Tiefen.
I don't know that's a good question. I don't know the answer right now, but we should follow up on that. That's a good, both of those are actually very good points.
And Madam Chair and Representative Kelly, I think it's
Representative Broad.
Maybe we weren't quite clear. The credit itself is $2,000 and $4,000, but there certainly is an ability for folks to put more money in if that's the amount of credit that they're going to get. So if somebody wants to put in $10,000 or $25,000, the credit stays the same. And that's where you have the cap of the $165,000, $175,000 in terms of the lifetime.
Follow up,
Senator. Okay,
Representative Kelly. Thanks, Senator. To that extent, then, Representative Broad, would the interest be exempt above the $2,000 that they put in? If they put in $25,000, would the interest that they earned off that be exempt from the state?
Representative Broad.
Madam Chair and Representative Kelly, that would be my understanding, but let me double check on that so I'm not giving you that information.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other members before I ask my questions. Okay. Well, and you can, of course, everyone should feel free to jump in if mine spur any of yours, but I'm just trying to get my arms around what this bill is about, and I have to say I hadn't read it before today, and I'm trying to listen and share the meeting at the same time, which I'm not that good at yet. But so, first of all, Representative Rod, you were talking about this gives people the opportunity to save for their own long-term care, and I just wanted to maybe make the point, see if you disagree with me. I mean, people do have the opportunity to save now, right? This doesn't give anyone, and all it gives them really is a tax advantage for those savings. Am I right, or is there Mm-hmm. Is there really more going on here than that?
No, I think what the opportunity is, it's more of an incentive to do, to save. And when you're absolutely right that people have the opportunity, they can stock money away and get taxed on it, put it in a savings account and let it sit there. But what this does is gives them a pre-tax or a tax preferred way of saving for their long-term care needs.
Okay, and then Representative Broad or Representative Thiessen, I guess Representative Kelly kind of went to this, but this doesn't, you know, assuming, say, somebody starts their account, they get their tax advantages for a couple of years, whatever, they've got a little bit of money, then they need the care. They run out of the money in the account. They're just in the same situation as anybody else at that point, am I right? In terms of Medicaid eligibility or, you know, spend down and all of that. Right?
It's not like the long-term care partnership in that sense. You're right, yes.
Okay.
I mean, and I think the other part of this, I think, is to give the incentive to save. I mean, the other part of this, I think, is it's maybe a small step, but it's one small step in really changing mindsets, too. And I think that's part of the bigger project that I think we're interested in, others are interested in really changing the mindset of Minnesotans about how we think about long-term care, because it is very true right now that the policy we have in the state is basically the state is going to pay for your long-term care. I mean, people do save. I mean, my wife and I are saving money, but at the end of the day, the lawyers will, you know, get involved and we'll figure out ways to kind of protect our assets, and that's, I think, what we want to change.
And also,
Representative Brad.
And also, Madam Chair, I think it gives people more flexibility and control over how these dollars are spent, and they don't have to come and ask somebody if they need to put a wheelchair ramp in their home. Their dollars are there to do it. And so I think it's a control issue also, so that folks are not always having to ask and wait for that funding. They certainly can use these dollars the most flexible way possible. Now, during a press conference, I said flexibly, so I'm making up words along the way, but certainly I think the point is that you've got to have dollars that are able to be controlled by the individuals, and this really moves in that direction too, and I think that's a really important component of what this does.
Well, Representative Broad, if it's your money, you always have control over it, you know? I mean, that's always a good thing. I think you mean, as opposed to buying an insurance policy where you have to then, you know, let the insurer then decide or, you know, see if it's covered under your policy. Is that kind of what you're talking about, how nice it is to be wealthy as opposed to having to be covered by insurance?
No, Madam Chair, what I'm talking about is when people end up spending down, they end up needing to come to the state and requesting assistance from in many different ways. And whether it's hoping for a grant or applying for a grant, they don't have to do that. They don't have to spend the time doing that. They have the money sitting there, and they can go and spend it as they wish.
Okay, so you're talking about the MA situation as opposed to, I'm sorry, I was thinking of the world of buying insurance, long-term care insurance, versus putting your money in this kind of an account that you're proposing.
And Madam Chair, I think that another important component of this bill is that it does allow those insurance premiums to be paid out of these dollars. And I think one of the things we do need is to expand that market for long-term care insurance so that there's additional products out there. And I think this helps move in that direction as well.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in Omnibus Policy Long-Term Care Bill. Thank you.
Thanks.
We will now call up House File 337, Representative Fritz. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Welcome to the committee, Representative Fritz. Representative Fritz moves House File 337 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy long-term care bill. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have before you again this year the tax credit bill that we had and many of you supported last year. It is supported also by the MS Society, AARP, Encourage Center, and others. This is a tax credit for $2,400 per year or $200 per month. We have been working along with the department. I want to say that this bill is changed slightly from the bill that I had before you last year. It's a revised version, and you'll see that in your bill research paper. But this does, again, address the issue of caretakers, families. Myself, my friends, I have a constituent, and I think many of you must as well, but I have a 66-year-old widow who is caring for her 92-year-old mother in the 66-year-old woman's home 24/7. I run into her occasionally at church, and she's always in a hurry to get back to her mother. I don't know what her means of support or her assets are, but she does oftentimes remind me that she is spending her own money out of pocket for additional things for the care of her mother. This happens quite a bit. I know in greater Minnesota, not all of our elderly are in nursing homes. Many of them are still in their homes or the homes of their daughters or sons, or perhaps their husband or wife are caring for them. So today I have this bill before you again. We have made some changes in order to make it less expensive. However, we look forward to moving this into the omnibus bill and having it included. And I have two testifiers I'd like to turn it over, and because of the time, I'd like to do that now. If you could hear from them, it'd be very good.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ritz. Okay. First testifier, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bangford. And I live in New Hope, Minnesota. Over the last 34 years, I've been a person with a disability. I broke my neck, a sustained spinal cord injury up near Moorhead, Minnesota. Because of this, I require personal care assistance every day, and I need help getting washed up, getting dressed in the morning, transferring to my wheelchair, meal preps, and many other activities of daily living. When I moved out into the world from the institutional care that I had in 1978, I was able to get personal care assistance through medical assistance for over 20 years. In 1996, I met a wonderful person I married, and the day after we were married, I got off the medical assistance, and since then have privately paid for our home care services or have hired or relied on my spouse, or hired a personal care assistant or have relied on my spouse for personal care assistance since then. I was very happy to get off of MA and feel blessed to be able to do so. If it were not for my wonderful wife, I would have been on MA for the last 12 and a half years and would continue to be on for the rest of my life. For each year I stay off of MA, the government saves at least $35,000 in personal care costs alone. And that's not to mention all the other medical costs that I would incur, or that I have incurred, I should say. In addition, the private insurance through my wife's employer further reduces the cost for me as well, and that takes up many of the acute care costs. Because we no longer have a paid caregiver, my wife has reduced her workload and her schedule in order to assist me. This has reduced our family's income and the amount she can contribute to her own retirement plan. I cannot even begin to express my gratitude for her unconditional love and devotion to help me with my cares. As I age, I shudder to think of what we will be forced to do as I become more dependent on people every day with my everyday activities. Many senior citizens are facing this issue right now. The last thing I want to do, again, is to go back on medical assistance. A few years ago, a tax preparer who was helping us said, "Most tax credits are based on choices we make in life, such as the child care tax credit, energy tax credits for cattle tuberculosis." Now, I'm not saying these are bad credits, but in some cases, people can make choices to get these tax credits. But he did say it did not seem fair for those who do not make the choice, like I didn't make the choice, to become disabled, that only a partial deduction is allowed for health care, which is for expenses over and above 7.5% of our income to assist us in this area. And under that 7.5%, we don't get a dime if we have those costs incurred. Even the state's long-term care insurance premium credit does not help me. I cannot get long-term care insurance because of my spinal cord injury is considered a pre-existing condition. I don't think there are many people who would think to purchase long-term care assistance prior to the age of 16, which is the time I broke my neck. We need more incentives for those who dramatically reduce medical assistance costs by caring for family members who require care up to 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Therefore, on behalf of those who are in a similar situation as I am, I hope you'll seriously consider passing this bill that Representative Fritz has brought before you here today. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions after we're done with testifying.
Okay. If members are okay with it, maybe we could hold questions and go on to the second testifier, and then we'll have some time for questions. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives, members of the committee. I'm Joan Molinar, the fella in purple. If you look to your whatever direction that is, it is my husband, Larry Molinar. He has dealt with MS since the late 60s. It's only been labeled for the last 30 years, but dealing with it for 40 years. In the early 70s, we made a choice when we were having children that I stayed home with the children, which then progressed into turning into my staying home to take care of them, except for some part-time flexible periodically over the years. And the word is flexible, because when you're giving full care to someone, or being the chief right arm, left hand, whatever title you want to use, you don't, or an employer cannot rely upon your work hours. I never regretted making the choice to be his full-time care, but it does make a difference in what we can do and our financial situation. In order for him to be gainfully employed, he stayed until, about 83, 84, and then I started driving him to work, because we live in a suburb. It was then a small town community, but now a suburb of Champlin, Minnesota. You don't rely on Metro transportation for handicapped people on a regular basis and really succeed in life. And then from 1987 to 1995, I became his full-time assistant so he could work at home by helping him with his daily needs. If he was now to be in a nursing home, he would be considered full care, whatever ABC letter that is these days. When his father was in the nursing home, he died in 2004. It was about $55,000 a year. I can only imagine what it must be now for in cost of nursing home care, because he would need a care for everything that he does. I can leave for a little while, or we make sure somebody else is there with him. So it is, and I don't regret it, but it would be a financial welcomed assistance if we could receive the taxpayer credit. We now have an additional bump in nuts to his disability retirement income, which is Social Security and a little bit from the company he worked for, because we now have an additional $500 a year with the changing employee requirements to pay for health care and co-pays to $500 a month to what he has financially. I chose not to take early Social Security the day I turned 62, so I could have a little bit of the few years that I did work in the late 60s, early 70s. To supplement our income. But that extra $500 is now just really laying us flat, no choices, and sometimes choosing which bills we can pay. I understand that I support Jeff Bainsberg's comments about the impact on choices families make and the cost it would take. And I assume his numbers, you are seeing them, you will find them mind-blowing if you had to do that too. And I know there are a lot of people who make the choices too with children that are disabled all their life. So appreciate the opportunity to share our experience with you, and look forward to hopefully this time, because 2 years ago we testified in the snowstorm, but unfortunately it was not passed, so we hope that this time it will be passed. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Molinar. I think I remember you're coming in to testify on this before. And,
we have snow on the wheelchair.
Yes. And Mr. Banksberg, I think you were here as well. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. I've been here a few times.
Yeah, I thought so. Okay. Well, very good. Members, do you have questions?
Yes.
I see one over here, Representative Rood, and then Gospel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing this before us again. And I just wanted to thank the testifiers. Joan, it is always good to see you, and please greet your daughter for me. She's a lovely person. And I just want to mention, I do sit on the tax committee, and the chair has suggested that we are going to be looking at all the tax credits. And I think Jesse brought up a really good point as to, you know, how we pick and choose who gets those credits. And so I will bring that message forward to the tax committee, and thank you again for being here. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Godwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, thanks for bringing this bill forward. I think these are the kinds of ideas we need as we look at long-term care solutions and long-term care in terms of not just elderly people, but people throughout their lives. There are a lot of people out there who are trying to provide care, and we ought to be encouraging them to do so and not necessarily having to default to public programs all the time. So I appreciate that. One question I had is I noticed as I looked through the bill, the tax credit qualification seems to be a rather complicated formula. So how you would determine whether or not you're eligible for it, any thought to simplifying that, making it a little more...
Yes, we have been working actually with the department. They've come to us with a number of amendments and suggestions, and we want to continue to work with them on that to simplify it.
Great. Thank you again for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for members? Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 337 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy long-term care bill.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, testifiers. Okay, members, I need to remind you that there will be a joint hearing with the Health Finance Committee and the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee this afternoon at 6:30 in room 200, and this is about the Minnesota Sex Offender System. So I hope that you all have that on your calendars. In addition to that, that will be just a one-hour hearing because session resumes after that. But if you would like to order dinner, Jen Holcomb has volunteered to coordinate dinner for us. So if you want to order some Jimmy John's, you should go to see Jen Holcomb in her office by 4:30, and that food will be delivered in time for the 6:30 hearing. So if you want to have dinner, go and see Jen Holcomb. All right, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.